on ABC Radio.
This is The Big Fish
with Scott Levi.
Coming up on The Big Fish, the boy who designed and built the dissolving fishhook for catch and release or incidental captures. He caught a freshwater turtle and thought, this is no good, we need a better hook. He's a great young lad. We'll catch up with him from South Australia on The Big Fish. Also doing a bit of reef fishing, a little bit of drifting off the beautiful south coast with Joe Starling, first cast. And Stinker is just back from Broughton Island with some tales of that amazing place. All coming up on The Big Fish. It's The Big Fish, and on the beautiful south coast of New South Wales, Joe Starling, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Going really well. Last time we spoke, it was about the girls just want to have fun Barra tournament.
Yes.
We spoke about the Barra Apprentice, a wonderful lady who had a ball up there, and you guys did really well in that big tournament with hundreds of women fishing it out. And we often talk about the other things you go into, the kayak fishing in fresh water, places like Windermere and all the rest, but and the estuary fishing and the fly fishing. But really, we haven't spoken about bread and butter fishing on the south coast. And I believe you and Steve did just that the other day and had a real blast.
Well, we did, absolutely. It was a bit of a reward because, as everyone would be aware, it was Gone Fishing Day on Sunday. And we had a wonderful day ourselves, but we were landlocked. We were up on our boat became our stage, and so we were at Huskisson helping people improve their fishing and just rubbing shoulders with our peers, as in the local South Coast anglers. So we didn't actually get to go fishing. So we rewarded ourselves on Tuesday. It was a glamour day, and our weather app got it absolutely right. So we got up. Goodness me, it would have been just after four, as you do when you're going for an offshore fish and hit the water. It was wonderful.
Well, just great. It was, you know, that this is very much bread and butter fishing. I know you love your sports fishing, your fly fishing, and your lure fishing. And you've got to watch it too when you say you've been catching up with your peers. A lot of people in the fishing world might think you've been fishing off a bridge or something. You know, around.
True, but it was E-double-E-R, not I-E-R.
That's not P-I-E-R-S. So how did you go? Did you do a bit of reef bashing and a little bit of bottom fishing?
Yes. So, it was just gorgeous, Scott. We launched out of Dalmeny, and there was virtually no surge. And as the sun was rising, it was actually really strange because the clouds were deforming that sun and making it really egg-shaped. It was very odd, but it was, you can visualise the apricots and the mauves and the deep purple in the sky. And then I was driving the boat out and just noticed there was something strange in the water up ahead. And sure enough, it was a pod of whales going through. And we slowed down, you know, what we're like with our cameras. We couldn't help it. But I missed the greatest shot of a whale that I've ever seen. However, I did get to catch it with my own eyes. It came up probably about 5 metres from the boat, belly to us, and with that beautiful coloration of the sky behind it and the sun rising, and just gave it a big flop. It was stunning. What a great way to start the day.
I mean, any fish after that's a bonus, really.
Oh, absolutely. I've never experienced anything like it. It was just stunning. But anyway, we headed out following out to some of our marks, actually just sort of out off Churros. So we launched because the mouth here is almost closed without rain. And it won't be very long, and once again, the mouth of Churros will be closed. So that's why we launched out of Dalmeny, but headed down to out in front of our little town. And just sounding around, looking for reef patches and all that sort of thing, pulling up. There are a load of cuda and a load of pike. But once we went out a little bit deeper and had a fish on the reef, my first fish would have been... nudging, I guess, a 45-centimetre snapper, which was great, on a soft plastic. So that was a load of fun, and that's what we were out there chasing, obviously. And we ended up with a really great bag of... We had one Maui, which was unusual because we ended up with about four snapper. Normally it works the other way around for us. We end up with more Maui. We only got the one Maui, and we got a lovely little nanagai. Some leather jackets were of size, and we all know they eat very well. A couple of sand flathead, and I think that's about where we ended up coming home for, you know, 3 hours of fishing and a lot of fun re-rigging with the barracuda. And yeah. One slimy mackerel came in, and we actually went and had a bit of a bait fish after the lure fishing and got a few more things, and so old slimy became that. But we're just so excited because our fridge is now full of fish, and this whole week we're just experimenting with different ways of cooking and preparing. And Saturday night I'm going to try and get that, you know, that fantastic crispy skin whole fish in the wok with the Asian.
I'm chasing
that with a couple of the pan size.
You sort of ladle the hot oil over the top and you cut the slits and you twist the fish. It looks great when it comes off, and you can virtually eat the whole fish, but I don't know how to do it.
Me neither yet.
Well, anyone out there? But I've seen it too where they do it with smaller fish, and they'll do it so crispy and so fierce that the bones, the fins, and the whole fish become like eating a big chip. And I've never tried it, but I've seen it on the cooking shows, and people will bite the tail off and crunch that and eat the entire fish.
Yes.
It's an Asian technique. Yeah.
Yeah. And because I used to turn my nose up at that sort of thing, you know, it's because Steve will eat prawn heads and, you know, everything. He just loves everything about it. I'm a little bit icky poo about prawn heads and guts and stuff like that, being a girl and all. But once upon a time out on a charter off the Abrolhos, they cooked me up some wings and all that and managed to get the wings crispy like that. And they're just a really crunchy chip. They're really, really good. So I encourage people, I'll go so far as to say those pectoral fins and the tail and all of that, yes, go for it.
Yeah, really nice and quite palatable, not particularly strong, a bit of fishy flavour,
it's more about texture.
Very nice, yeah, very crispy and lovely, but I've never had the whole fish, you know, fried to the point where you can just bite straight through the bones. But that's what they do. So good luck with that.
I'm really looking forward.
You can't beat the sand flathead, can you, for food? I mean, they're just so good.
Yeah, absolutely. There are very few fish, you know, as long as they're not poisonous, I think, that can't be treated well. We've discovered with the Maui that they're really delicious. But it requires you to actually cut out in the top shoulder, up behind the top of the skull, there's a much redder piece of meat, a darker piece of meat. And if you cut that out before you, cook the fish, you don't get that strong, strange flavour that Maui get. You just taste like a good eating fish. So there's a tip for everyone.
Well, that's given Mo Wong a bad reputation over the years. So that's
an interesting tip.
And there's nothing wrong with the old Chinaman leather jacket, deep sea leather jacket.
Absolutely, particularly
if you stick it on the ice and treat it well. They are magnificent to eat. Great fare.
Absolutely. And I think there are so many of these what people couldn't consider second string fish that if they investigated further and looked out at how to look after the catch and how to prepare it and what parts to prepare, they'd find it much easier to get themselves a good feeder fish.
It was interesting. Years ago when I was living in Wagga, we went across to Marimbula for a holiday, and it was a lovely place. Just staying in this duplex, and the old fellow and his wife who owned the duplex, we were renting one side of it, and he had a big boat, you know, and I went down to the beach. I got some really nice flathead and whiting and brim, and I brought them back and I gave them a feed of fish. And he said, "Oh, you like fishing?" I said, "Oh, I love fishing." And he said, "Well, go out tomorrow morning." So 4 o'clock the next morning, knock, knock, knock. There he is. He said, "Come on." So I grabbed one of the kids and out we went, and we went out to the reef to get some snapper, and we got a couple of big deep sea leather jackets. He said, "Oh, you can't eat those. They're poisonous." I said, "You watch me." So I prepared them and skinned them. He'd never seen how you just pull the skin off. They're the easiest fish in the world to clean. Cut the head through, the guts come away, and, you know, had it ready to go at the boat ramp in 3 seconds. And I said, "These are poor man lobster, mate. These are great." Anyway, we didn't do too well on the snapper. Got a couple of moeys, and He said, oh, we'll go in now. I said, why don't we have a drift for Flathead? And he said, what do you mean? I said, I'll show you. Anyone can do that. I mean, it's not as if I'm teaching him anything new, but he just had no idea. Anyway, I got a nice feed of Flathead. I took some lovely fillets off and gave them the tail pieces, took the pin bones out, and boy, they just loved it. And we were there for a week. Next morning, 4 o'clock, knock, knock, knock. You ready to go? I said, all right, off we go. So out we go to sea again. Next morning, knock, knock, knock. You ready to go again? And I said, by about 4 days at sea, I said, mate, I think we'll just stay at home today.
Yeah.
He loved it so much. But so many people just don't know how to do it. We just assume people know how to do it, don't we?
We do. And, it isn't hard, but there are different techniques. And it just pays to do a little bit of investigation and ask some questions, because it can really open up your world, and provide you with better opportunities, more opportunities if the weather isn't playing to allow you to go out wider for the snapper or whatever. There's still plenty that you can do in closer. Steve assures me that barracuda smoke up really well. This is a good thing.
They do get a little bit wormy sometimes.
Do they?
Yeah, I don't like that. But no. They're not the sorts of worms you can catch. It's not like the northern tapeworm.
No, but it does put you off when you find them.
It does.
Because I had that up in Darwin.
Yeah, they get into the guts of coral trout too, those worms. And, but who wouldn't eat coral trout? And once you cook it, no one knows. But they do put you off a bit.
They do, because we had sleepy cod up in the Territory, which is I don't know if anyone down here has ever seen one, but they're sort of halfway between, I guess, the closest thing to a freshwater flatty, but they're higher, and they're not a pretty looking fish. Anyway, they're much rounder than a flathead in the face and all that. But we were starting to catch them, and we wondered what they tasted like. So we took one home. They actually taste quite good, but they are riddled with the little worms all the time. And Steve assured me that, once you cook them up, they sort of dissolve, those worms. They're just so tiny. But it's really hard to get your head around it sometimes.
It is a bit, yeah. It does. I'm not impressed with the parasites that get in the blackfish and the silver trevally and the yellowtail either. The ones that get in their throat and in the leather, in the estuary leather jackets too. They always put me off a bit. I'm not a big fan of parasites for some reason.
No. But, maybe it's a safety mechanism or a defence mechanism that they've...
Yeah, but, we are really lucky, aren't we, because no fish that I know of in Australia carry a parasitic worm that can go from fish to human, but there are other parts of the world, particularly up Scandinavia, the fish tapeworm is quite common, isn't it? It can go from the fish into a human, and that wouldn't be nice, but with us,
put me off fishing, I think.
I'm feeling a bit queasy. It's too early in the morning to talk about this. Joe Starling's our guest, and Joe, there's a big event that you're involved in publicising coming up in Hobart for the keen, caring anglers around Australia, I believe.
Absolutely, we've got the. It happens biennially, so every second year we have the National Recreational Fishing Conference, and this year it's Hobart's turn. And the work that's gone into it is incredible. The topic this year generally is our fishing, our research, our recreational future. And so there's a lot of speakers talking about citizen science and the impact of citizen science, the importance of it to our fishing future. But also other great things around healthy habitat and everything to do with maintaining recreational fishing in Australia. So I would suggest to anyone who's keen to get on to the website, or you can just Google National Recreational Fishing Conference. It should come up. It's run by our Australian Recreational Fishing Foundation, and it also has the Rec Fishing Awards, which has just been open for nominations. So get on. Facebook is full of all of this stuff. So get on and make sure that you nominate the people that you think are worthy and perhaps the unsung heroes of recreational fishing, because we don't get many other opportunities to let them know how good we think they're doing. I'm really happy to be working with the guys this year as their communications person, and have been thoroughly enjoying the ride. It looks like it's going to be a great event. And the really inspiring thing is that for the first time ever, they've got virtual tickets, so you can attend as a virtual delegate. If you can't afford or make the time to get down to Hobart, you can actually buy a ticket that will allow it to, the whole conference to stream live to your device, so you can still attend. That's pretty cool.
You can attend and not attend.
Indeed.
You could sit at home somewhere in New South Wales and watch the proceedings in Hobart.
Exactly, and still find out all the great information that's going to be shared from people from all around the country and all around the world with regards to keeping us fishing. But if we only allow the science that the people on our side, the people who are managing our fisheries, if we only allow them to use science that we're not participating in, science that's driven by other entities who perhaps don't have the longevity of recreational fishing at heart, then we're compromising our chances of keeping things real and keeping ourselves fishing. So we need a bit of a mindset change with regards to the cynicism and the scepticism that we throw at the scientists who are on our side, you know, who are working to find the true data that we need to make sure that recreational fishing is sustainable. And the other thing, Scott, that it's not just running out of fish or bad habitat that threatens our fishing. It's also the general public, the non-fishing public's opinion of us and their support of us fishing. And that comes down to our behaviour, how we express ourselves online and publicly, but also what benefits we bring to the planet. And if we're participating in science and participating in citizen science and demonstrating that we have a mindfulness or a desire for recreational fishing and all the environment and the habitat to survive, the fish, you know, if we're good custodians, if we're guardians of that of the habitat and the resource, then we're not doing anything that they would want to shut us out from. And we all know recreational fishing has benefits beyond putting food on our table. It's sort of my solace. It sustains my physical and mental well-being, as it does for so many other people, and it keeps families together and all sorts of things. So there's a lot to like, but if we, as collectively, as recreational fishers, tend to put forward the ugly side of recreational fishing, then society itself can shut down on us, and that's something that I think many people miss.
I think that's a very, very valid point. We've had examples of that of late, you know, people hanging up beautiful sharks and just killing them for killing sake. That's not what I believe is recreational fishing, and really those sorts of things have to change. That doesn't give us a good name, and really sustainability has to be always at the forefront, because if the methods aren't sustainable, change the methods. Fisheries around the world that are well managed are proactive in using all the tools. Rod and line fishing can be really sustainable, as we've seen in the recreational fishing havens like Lake Macquarie and Botany Bay, and you know down on the south coast, where the fish stocks have never been better because we're using management to still fish but have our fish too. It is something that's quite achievable and has been achieved all around the world. So we need to embrace that science. The National Recreational Fishing Conference, Hobart, coming up in December. And the motto is Our Fishing, Our Research, Our Recreational Future, which will be rosy if we take on board the ideas of proactive management. I think, Joe, you know, it can work both ways.
Yes, it sure can.
All right.
To all of us.
We might even see if we can catch up with some of the keynote speakers and whatnot to give it a bit of a wrap. But who's eligible to go to that? Is it
anyone
who likes to have a fish?
Yeah, absolutely. Anyone. The Australian Recreational Fishing Foundation is basically the national peak body for recreational fishers, and they work on behalf of us at a federal level, and they work with all our peak bodies too to achieve the outcomes we need and to wrestle with the issues that need wrestling with.
Tight lines, Joe Starling. Thanks for telling us all about it. We'll catch you next time on The Big Fish.
Looking forward to it. Thanks, Scott.
And coming up on The Big Fish, Stinker, just back from Broughton Island, had some great adventures. He'll share that with us. Also coming up, catching up with Fraser Willetts, the 11-year-old boy who invented a better fish hook after hooking a freshwater tortoise and or turtle. Turtle. And thinking there's got to be a better way when we have to cut the line on an incidental catch. They came up with a great idea. It needs a bit of refining, but we'll talk about that story in just a moment. We'll catch up with a young Fraser and his dad, Danny, who's an Englishman, who's a coarse fisherman, who brought those wonderful techniques over from England. And they were fishing for freshwater fish at the time, actually, when Fraser had his light bulb moment. Joe Starling there, of course, it was the secret women's business Barra tournament. I think I called it the girls just want to have fun Barra tournament, but gee, they did have a lot of fun. And Nadia Taylor was the Barra apprentice too. So some wonderful things happening with Joe and women in fishing.
The Big Fish with Scott Levi on ABC Radio.
Very practical people, fisher folk. If they see a problem, they fix it. 11-year-old Fraser Willetts from the Adelaide Hills caught a turtle and thought, oh, gee, I've got to cut the line, but I hope that hook dissolves, and realised that it'd take some time. So went to school, used the latest technology, and came up with a fantastic solution. Fraser is 11, and his dad, Danny, is a very proud dad as well. G'day, Danny.
G'day, how are you?
And tell us about the incident that spurred him on to invent a more environmentally friendly, sustainable fish hook.
So I thought of it because, yeah, I caught the turtle. And so I designed it because if a fish were to have it in its mouth or get gut hooked and you have to cut the line, the hook would just dissolve in its belly.
And how did you go about not only designing it, manufacturing it too?
I used the school's 3D printers from a material called PLA, which is a dissolvable material that, yeah, dissolves in water for 2 hours.
And take us to the incident that spurred you on, Fraser. Where were you fishing? Were you with Dad? And I can hear that he might be an Englishman. Is he a coarse fisherman?
Yeah. We were at Mount Crawford.
We're freshwater. We're members of the South Australian Freshwater Fishing Association. And that's where we actually caught the turtle. Obviously, we weren't using one of these hooks. We're using a metal hook as normal. We're coarse fishermen, but we do like sea fishing as well.
What were you fishing for, Danny and Fraser? Were you chasing the elusive carp?
No, mainly redfin.
Ah, the old English perch. Yes, both transplants from the old country, Danny. I love watching those coarse fishing competitions where there's 100,000 pounds on the line and the bloke will catch a 10-pound carp, and it's like the greatest achievement of his life. And I think, geez, you can go up the Murray and catch a 10,000 of those if you want to.
Yeah, well, Fraser's big what he wants to catch now is Murray cod. He's not caught his first Murray cod yet, so that's on his bucket list.
All right, well, great to talk to you both this morning. Thank you so much for joining us so early on The Big Fish. Fraser Willetts and Danny Willetts. Tight lines, boys.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
As well.
Yeah, so he's got the big bucket mouth on the bucket list, young Fraser Willetts in South Australia, who invented the dissolving fish hook. Still working on the nuance of it, but he'll get there. It's a great initiative. It's The Big Fish coming up, Stinker on Broughton Island, and we'll also have a look at the Sydney scene as well, see what's biting there.
Ain't no fish, ain't no flounder, ain't no tuna. Ain't no fish.
Holy mackerel, some days there just ain't no fish.
Ain't no perch.
Ain't no flounder. You flounder for fish.
Ain't no fish.
And although at times you get a mess full, other days are less successful. Some days there just ain't no fish.
Ain't no fish. Ain't no fish.
Some days we'll start mighty fine.
With a splash.
With a nibble that tugs at your line.
Mighty fine.
But you reel it in to find you caught a beat-up shoe that's leaking water. Some days there just ain't no fish.
Get out of it, bloody seagulls.
The Big Fish with Scott Levi on ABC Radio.
Here comes Stinker with his fishing tips. Some hot advice for your fishing trip. Where to find them? What's the bait?
Are you catching any, mate?
Morning, Stinker.
Hey, g'day, Scott.
And look, I was lucky to get you. You're still on island time, aren't you? And I'm not talking about Bora Bora or Tahiti or Hawaii. You've been to your favourite island, but you can see that island out of your window, can't you, at Fingal Bay?
I can, Scott. It's the most beautiful place, really, when it comes to... I'm a bit hooked on islands. I don't know whether it's the Robinson Crusoe in me or I don't know, but it just seems to me that you've become more of an individual if you're on an island. I suppose, well, being Australians, we're all on an island to a degree, aren't we? But anyway, the island you refer to is Broughton Island, and I've written a book about Broughton Island, and so I've studied it as probably as deeply as anybody, and I actually uncovered some amazing photographs taken in 1906 of Broughton Island, which show research station and accommodation for a scientist and his assistants. And the scientist was taken and brought to Broughton Island in a research attempt to eliminate rabbits from the mainland of Australia, which were running crazy all through the pastoralists' grounds and the farmers right throughout, well, Australia pretty much, because rabbits went crackers, you know. Some of those old photos are rabbits. So you're wondering what rabbits has got to do with this island. But it was a controlled research that they took rabbits onto Broughton Island and they put them in a big cage and they injected them with a virus, hoping that virus would spread from one rabbit to another. This is pre-myxomatosis. But that did not happen. The rabbits that were injected died. The ones that weren't injected didn't die. But then the Frenchman, it was a French scientist that actually came over from Paris to conduct this study. And he left. His name was Danzig, Dr. Danzig, who I'm told was a nephew of Louis Pasteur. This is one great story, isn't it? And then he left the island disillusioned and unsuccessful. And, of course, the rabbits were glad to see the end of him. And they have thrived there until around about 6 or 7 years ago, when National Parks and Wildlife thought, enough's enough, we've got to get rid of these rabbits. So they dropped pellets from a helicopter. Everyone was evacuated from the island. And it was incredibly effective. And all the rats and the rabbits and the cockroaches that really were thriving on the island were cleaned out. And now the island is... I've never seen it better, Scott.
It's a wonderful effort, isn't it? They've done really, really well. They took those special dogs out to make sure they'd gotten rid of every single rat and every single rabbit. And the place was infested with them. They were really causing havoc with the seabirds. It's all national park. It's a great nesting area for little penguins and shearwaters and all sorts of wonderful birds, isn't it? I mean, it's just a paradise now for those native animals.
Well, that's the case. And I have noticed a great increase in the number of particularly sea eagles. It was great to see. There's Brahmini kite. A lot of birds of prey are over there. Peregrine falcon. Fastest bird on wings, they tell me. And, oh, look, it is just the place is... It never. And quails, there's beautiful quails. Anyone who studies bird life, it would be the place to go. The cisticula, the golden-headed cisticula. I'm not a crazed ornithologist, but I do appreciate the bird life. And, of course, the shearwater or the mutton bird. Well, he's over there at this time of the year, and do they make a racket? Holy, yeah, you can have all night. It sounds like someone's choking somebody out in the bush. They're all screaming and squawking and carrying on. It's just a boiling mess of life, and the vegetation has come back. So congratulations to National Parks and Wildlife. Now, they don't get too many pats on the back, Scott, but I'm giving one almighty pat on the back.
The animal that's there, Stinker, that I think is an extraordinary animal, and you wouldn't think that it would live there on a saltwater-surrounded island with very little freshwater, is the rare and endangered and beautiful. It's just the most magnificent-looking frog in Australia, the green and gold bell frog. It's a big frog, too, and they live there over the other side of the island, don't they?
They do, and I'm led to believe that it's the biggest natural population, naturally occurring population, of this particular frog in Australia. And it lives on this island in a little patch of swamp about a quarter of the size of footy field, and it faces directly to the north towards Silver Rocks. And I've been over there, and it's loaded up with tadpoles of these things. And it really is quite an extraordinary environment, because it's not what you'd call fresh water, because there'd be salt get in it somehow or other. So it's a mixture of wouldn't be much salt in it. But it's very stagnant and quite smelly. But the frogs think it's heaven, heaven on earth for a bell frog. And so they're going great guns, and it's a wonderful thing to happen. I mean, the island has got so much to offer, with beautiful frogs and birds and rocks and trees. And trees, actually, there's another issue. There is no evidence of any broad trunk trees, no what you call a fair dinkum tree. And the vegetation on Broughton Island is totally different to the vegetation on the two islands closest to it, which are Boondall Bar and Cabbage Tree Island. There's three islands in a row. Now, each of the islands have their own personality. And quite strangely, the vegetation, although they're within 15 kilometres from one island to the other, and then the other one's in the middle. So there's three islands within 15K, and they all have a different vegetation. So really, and one of them, of course, which is Cabbage Tree Island, has the Gould's Petrel, a tiny bird, a seabird, a bit like a tern, that is the only nesting place, certainly in the Southern Hemisphere, and I haven't been told where else in the world that it actually nests. So there's only one small spot on the western face of Cabbage Tree Island that this tiny little bird nests. So on your way, even on the way to Broughton Island in the boat, you go past these other islands, and they're just beautiful, absolutely beautiful. And there's a story to be told about every island as you go.
Yeah, great story about the fellow who saved the Gould's Petrel and lived on the side of a cliff for years. He was a maniac, a great scientist, great effort.
Well, there's a story too. Nicholas Karloff, and he, what a great job he did, because that Gould's Petrel was threatened. It was doing it tough, real tough. And there's a reason behind that, because some deal threw rabbits onto the island many years ago on the Cabbage Tree Island. Now, the rabbits ate all the foliage or the undergrowth, not the undergrowth, the undergrowth, and which exposed the eggs of the Gould's Petrel, because that's where they nest. They don't nest up in trees, they nest on the ground. So the eggs were exposed. So the crows and the corowans come over from the mainland and got stuck into their eggs. Well, this is a catastrophe. So what happens? Nicholas goes over there. He gets rid of the rabbits. He gets rid of the crows. He gets rid of the corowans. The undergrowth grows, covers up the eggs, and yahoo, you're in business. The birds have made a remarkable comeback. But just to make sure that this is not another sort of calamity will occur, they've taken some boxes, small boxes, and put them on the other island so that the birds have now a choice. So if one colony gets wiped out, there is still another colony on other islands that make sure that the birds thrive. I mean, it's just a wonderful story.
It is a great story. I was just looking it up online, and a photographer I know, Esther Beaton, who's a beautiful nature photographer, has a photo of Nicholas Carlisle standing on top of the island with his hair blowing in the wind, and it's so sheer and so steep. And you showed me when we went around the back of the island in the boat, the little hut up on the cliff, and he used to get up and down by ropes. You know, you wouldn't want to sleepwalk there, Stinker.
Oh, just, it would be dangerous to walk out at 1 o'clock in the morning for a little twinkle and fall 80 feet. You know, I mean, you've got to be careful.
Yeah.
But yes, they've done a wonderful job, absolutely wonderful. And I spent the last 4 days over there, 5 days, and, of course, the fact that a lot of variables come into play, whether you have a good trip or not so good trip. And the main variable, the one that you really can't control, is the weather.
We might come back and see how you went after this, Stinker, on the Big Fish. Get your stories from Broughton Island. You've been there for 4 days, looking a little bit more rugged than usual. And I can hear in your voice that it might have been a successful journey. Well, it's always successful, but you might have caught a few fish as well.
That's about the case.
Wipe the sleep from my eyes. It's a weekend, I can drop my disguise. Better get it moving before the sun rises. Wonder what's on the missus' list. I bring my flathead, I wish. I better tune in to the Big Fish. Yeah, I better tune in to the Big Fish.
It's the Big Fish with John Stinker Clark, and Stinker's back from 4 days on Broughton Island, living like Robinson Crusoe. How did you go, mate?
Oh, great trip. And I've been there many, many times. I try to go there four or five times a year, and this particular trip that I just came back was really first class because, well, one reason was, I mentioned it earlier, the weather. The weather was superb, a 10 out of 10. So we motored up, myself and a friend, and another boat, there were two boats went up there, and the other boat had three people on it, three fishermen, and myself and my mate. And so the five of us motored up there in a gentle southerly wind and then stayed for 4 days, then turned around, come home in a gentle northerly wind. So the wind just gently pushed us up and gently brought us home. And while we were up there, we concentrate on catching snapper. We've got some beautiful snapper. We don't go chasing bad bulls. You don't try and get your bag in it. I mean, I don't know. Everyone seems to be, you know, they try, and if they don't get their bag in it, they feel as though they've had an unsuccessful day. Well, that's not the case. You really, if you don't need your bag in it, don't bother getting your bag in it. And really, we don't freeze fish. We eat all our fish. I guess we're fortunate to be able to do that. And so we've got some beautiful snapper. The whiting are starting to sneak onto the beaches, and the dusky fatted. They'll be there for the summer months. They'll be there. The squid, there's a few squid, not many, around the island. The bonito have arrived. They're there. Brim, of course, there's quite a few brim around the island. The whales heading south, we nearly run into a couple of them, and you don't want to do that. They're on a mission, and you don't want to get in their road. So, and dolphins, oh, blimey, there's dolphins all over the place. It's just a spectacular. It's like a wonderland. And then the birds, which I mentioned earlier, so you've got the whole lot jumping around. And, of course, there's a heap of sand flathead up there too. If you like to go out into 50 metres, you'll go and get in the beautiful sand flathead. It's up and down fishing, which doesn't excite me all that much, but that's okay. There are beautiful flathead to be caught. So, you know, the options, there's plenty of options. And then, of course, I take a face mask and a snorkel. So then I jump over the side and snorkel around a bit, and the water was beautiful. Beautiful temperature, and you can see right up past Seal Rocks and even further north and the beaches. Well, you've got to see them to believe them. And there was very, very few people around. So all in all, it was a very successful trip. We got snapper up to 3.5 kilo. No monsters, but you're not there to break the world record. You're just there to catch a few fish and enjoy yourself and have a couple of beers and lay back and relax. That's about it.
And finally, Stinker, a bit of controversy in the game fishing world, dividing the game fisher folk. They're very upset about the brigade who go out and kill stuff for killing's sake. It's hard to understand this idea of killing giant creatures and hanging them up and then throwing them away, tiger sharks and marlin and things. Most people have got away from that, but when it does happen, it does fire up the people, doesn't it? And probably makes it harder to defend fishing because, you know, if you go out and get a couple of fish for a feed, it's very justifiable. But if you're going out just for self-aggrandizement and to kill something majestic and say, look what I killed, it doesn't go over too well these days, does it?
It does not. And quite frankly, I thought we were over that. In Port Stephens, which is a hub, it's a focus of game fishing. And, how many years? 15 years ago, I guess, game fishing was a bit on the nose in this community because of all the sharks and whatever else hung up by the tail and on display. And anyway, there was sort of a movement to say to the game fishing, look, if you're going to come here, let's try tag and release, which is what happened to you now. And, of course, now they've become very welcome in our game. Game fishermen are very welcome now in Port Stephens, mainly because it's not this great display of, look what I've killed. There's research to be done, and no one's denying anyone the opportunity to go out and catch these big fish. But really, if you're not going to eat it, don't keep it.
Good on you, Stinker. Tight lines. Thanks for talking to us again on The Big Fish.
ABC Radio, it's The Big Fish with Scott Levi.
And the future for trout fishing in Australia isn't looking so good with the drought. Terrible up on the New England with fires and drought and a lot of that cold water running out, and in the snowies as well, there's a lot of demand for the water and possibly that water becoming a lot warmer. It'll push the trout further and further up into the headwaters. But certainly there's a little Aussie battler waiting in the wings who could come out fighting and take the place of that trout and survive the droughts, survive the lack of flowing water, and be a beautiful clear water sports fish that takes flies and lures and it fights really very well pound for pound. It's good to eat if they get to the stage where we've got enough of them to eat again. And all in all, it's a bright future if the little Aussie battler gets its way. And Luke Pearce researches and studies this beautiful fish and joins us on the line. Good morning, Luke.
Morning, Scotty.
Who am I talking about?
You're talking about the Macquarie perch, Scott.
Yeah. Now, you've got this wonderful experiment happening out in the Retreat River out in the central west, and the Macquarie perch have been through a few big dry summers there. How have they fared?
Yeah, look, they're faring okay. Like, obviously, not as well as they would be if the river had good flows and lots of water in it, but they're surviving and you know, there's really good refuge locations in that river for them fish to survive those hot, dry periods. There's big, deep pools where these fish can bunker down and survive through those really hot, dry periods, and stand much higher temperatures than things like trout can as well. So, yeah, it's really promising. You know, the fish are still recruiting in that system and surviving through, you know, what has been some of the driest periods we've seen in that part of the world as well. So,
you and I have fished a lot together, and there's nothing that gets our pulse racing more than, you know, you spotting or me spotting or whatever and sneaking up a clear mountain stream, seeing a good fish, putting a dry fly over its head and watch it come up off the bottom and take that fly. For me, that's the pinnacle, and I think that's what drives you for fly fishing as well. Will a Macquarie perch do that if we've got enough of them in the rivers to be sustainable and viable?
Yeah, absolutely they will, Scott. So, interesting thing about Macquarie perch and trout is they have very similar diets. So they basically eat the same thing and have very similar habits and habitat requirements as well. So, you know, anything that a trout eats, a Macquarie perch eats, and basically they feed in very similar ways as well. And I've actually caught a Macquarie perch on a dry fly, actually thinking that it was a brown trout. I just saw this dark shape at the head of a pool, dipping mayflies off the top, and I thought, oh, here's a good brown, and put a mayfly emerger over the top of it, and whack, this thing hit it, and then dragged me all around this pool for about 5 minutes, and then I finally landed it. And much to my surprise and delight, it was a Macquarie perch rather than the brown trout that I thought it was, and it was a new location where we didn't know Macquarie perch still existed. So, you know, that was exciting on a number of levels for me. One, that, you know, these things, you know, will take a fly and feed very similar to a trout, but also, you know, that they were still persisting in this catchment where we didn't even know they were. But, you know, the other thing about Macquarie perch is, you know, that they've been gone from most of our systems for so long that people just don't, you know, aren't aware or don't remember, you know, how abundant and common this particular species was, and how much of a revered and, you know, sought after recreational and table species it was. Like, you know, in most of our, you know, upland sort of reaches of the southern Murray-Darling Basin, you know, Macquarie perch was one of the most abundant, if not the most abundant, freshwater fish in a lot of these systems. And they, you know, supported huge recreational fisheries and subsistence fisheries, and had huge, you know, value for the Aboriginal people before that as well. So, you know, and there's no reason why, you know, with a bit of further research and some solid investment, that we couldn't, you know, see the return of this species more broadly than it currently is.
It'd be interesting to take one in a big, fast-flowing river. That archival footage from the ABC that you showed me of this river full of big ones at breeding time, that was just salivating stuff. Where was that?
Yeah, so that's on the Goulburn River down in Victoria, below Eildon Dam. And, you know, and it's just incredible. The size of those fish was amazing. And in a big, fast-flowing river like that, if you caught one of those, you'd have a really hard job landing it. It'd just be quite a epic battle, I think. But, yeah, unfortunately, they're not down in that system anymore. But, you know, there's no reason why eventually, if we, you know, work at it, we can't get them back in there and other places as well. And you know, as you mentioned earlier on, you know, as things become hotter and drier with climate change and you know, exacerbated by, you know, the current situation with the drought, you know, a lot of trout waters are becoming marginal. If we want to see, you know, viable fisheries maintained in some of these areas that, you know, becoming too marginal for trout, then, you know, this is a really, really viable alternative, but also a really exciting alternative. And the thing that really excites me about it, Scott, is that this is something you can't catch anywhere else in the world. You know, this is our unique fish that you can't find or catch anywhere else in the world. And that, you know, that has real sense of appeal to me. You know, you can go anywhere in the world and catch a trout, you know, well, there's nowhere else you can go and catch a Macquarie perch. And you know, that could have, you know, whole value of, you know, of ramifications, you know, in terms of, you know, the, I guess, you know, the boutique or the, you know, the
tourism, yeah.
To the fishery, yeah.
The fishing tourism.
Yeah.
But you and I are both fishing tourists, I know. No, many of them will travel anywhere to catch a fish, and if that was, and you know, the fact that they'll rise to take aquatic insects as they rise to the surface, mayflies sip mayflies off the top, that does it for me. We've got to fight to get these back. It's great the work you're doing in the Retreat River in the Central West. Good to know there's still water for them there, and we did share the news that they bred successfully there too, didn't we? So that was
we sure did. Yep. And I think the really exciting thing about that is, you know, it's a test case and gives us a model that we can replicate elsewhere. You know, we've proven that we can do it. We've proven that we can breed these things in captivity. We've proven that we can establish populations from those captive bred fish, and that those populations will recruit in the wild. So, you know, all we need to do now is the next step is to, you know, to further that research and upscale it a bit and find, you know, other areas where we can establish populations as well. And unfortunately, you know, we don't have the resources to do that at the moment, but we're working really hard to try and get those, and hopefully we will secure them, and that'll allow us to bring these fish back more broadly across the system.
I tell you what, all of the anglers are cheering you on. A great animal, the Macquarie perch. Luke Pearce, keep up the good work, and maybe you're an alternative if the trout can't survive in our conditions.
Absolutely, Scott, and we'll put that link up for that footage of them in the Goulburn River, and that'll get them salivating even more.
I'll put it on the Big Fish Facebook. It really is quite extraordinary, and boy, what a great species. Thanks for joining us again on the Big Fish, Luke.
My pleasure, Scott.
The Big Fish with Scott Levi on ABC Radio.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.